The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So this morning I'd like to spend this time exploring some aspects of the middle way. And this is, as you probably all know, one of the foundational teachings of the Buddha. And I thought we might start by I'm going to read briefly the account of his giving of this teaching, because in fact, when I went back and read it, I got a little surprise. You know how you think you remember how it is, and then it isn't quite that way. Maybe I'm the only one that missed this point, but I'll share my error with you anyway. Once the Blessed One lived near Raja Griha on Vulture Peak. At that time, while the Venerable Sona lived alone and secluded in the cool forest, this thought occurred to him. Of those disciples of the Blessed One who are energetic, I am one, yet my mind has not found freedom. He's working hard out there. Now the Blessed One, perceiving in his own mind the Venerable Sona's thoughts, left Vulture Peak, and as speedily as a strong man might stretch his bent arm or bend his stretched arm, he appeared in the cool forest before the Venerable Sona. And he said to the Venerable Sona, Sona, did not this thought arise in your mind? Of those disciples of the Blessed One who are energetic, I am one, yet my mind has not found freedom. Yes, Lord. Tell me, Sona, in earlier days, were you not skilled in playing stringed music on a lute? Yes, Lord. And tell me, Sona, when the strings of that lute were too taut, was then your lute tuneful and easily playable? Certainly not, O Lord. And when the strings of your lute were too loose, was then your lute tuneful and easily playable? Certainly not, O Lord. But when, Sona, the strings of your lute were neither too taut nor too loose, but adjusted to an even pitch, did your lute then have a wonderful sound, and was it easily playable? Certainly, O Lord. Similarly, Sona, if energy is applied too strongly, it will lead to restlessness. And if energy is too lax, it will lead to lassitude. Therefore, Sona, keep your energy in balance and balance the spiritual faculties, and in this way focus your intention. Yes, O Lord, replied the Venerable Sona in assent. And it worked for him. Now, the surprise for me when I remembered this story was I thought that the point was that if it was neither too taut nor too loose, it would have a beautiful result, a beautiful tone, that you'd be able to see it like that, you know, that it was the desired objective. What I didn't remember at all was that the point of the Buddha's teaching was how you apply your energy. Still get to the same place, but I completely missed the energy involved in the practice, in his case of example of playing the lute. And of course, Sona was out there being macho man under the tree. I am an energetic and, you know, I still haven't accomplished what I want. One of the reasons that I decided to talk about the middle way was because in recent weeks, as I've been reading here and reading there, things about the middle way kept popping up. And although in one sense I can say that the teaching of the middle way is, you know, fairly easy to comprehend, At the same time, I think in my mind, I saw it as something like a yardstick, and the middle way is 18 inches, you know. That if you're talking about anger, you know, rage or abject fear, that there's this mental state which has a name, which would be at the 18-inch mark, and that the objective was whatever you were engaged in, it was to find 18 inches. Some people, I think, see the teaching of the middle way as a suggestion that we should actually find some sort of state. It's kind of like vanilla, you know. There's this sort of bland, non-stressful place in the middle of life, and you can kind of sit there. And then the more I thought about this, the more examples. I reread the story of Goldilocks and the Three Bears yesterday. And that was something. Is the middle way what some people have? You know, Goldilocks was a real 75 degrees and always sunny kind of girl, you know. Is the middle way the same thing as having your comfort zone? You know. I have a visual aid and I made it myself. For those of you who are listening and can't see, I have a piece of yarn attached to a very large nut, and it's a pendulum. Energy, 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 right? The point of the pendulum is that the farther you swing it, do you remember when you were in physics in high school and you could calculate potential energy? Energy. I seem to have returned to childhood because I keep thinking of these childhood examples, you know, Goldilocks. Do you remember shooting spitballs in third grade? And the farther you pulled back and created more potential energy, the farther the spitball would go. Sometimes we think, if this is what life is like, I see if I can do this, I tried last night, that we'd like to live like this. Not rain and, you know, sun, rain and snow, sun, sun, sun. Well, we can't do that either. The Buddha also taught a lot of, he gave a lot of examples of what is not the middle way. I mean, the very first one was greed, hatred, and delusion, right? There's greed, and there's hatred, and there's delusion, who's being oblivious that it's even going on. Dogen, when the opposites arise, the Buddha mind is lost, which implies that there's something somewhere, must be in the middle, that he's referring to. Think of neither good nor evil. Consider right, neither right nor wrong. And then there's the eight worldly conditions. Wait, I can do this. This is a good one. Gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disgrace, elation and sorrow. When you are going back to energy, when you're living in the world of the opposites, it requires a lot of expenditure of energy. I mean, what is extreme elation like? You know, you look at cheerleaders at a football game, you know, that's, you know. And then the opposite, what happens when you feel completely defeated? There's none. You know, you're off in the corner of your room curled up in a little ball. A lot of what we go through is an experience of different energy states. But I thought of one example which was completely different. Think about martial arts, which I have never practiced and wouldn't consider it in a million years. But there stands the martial artist, and the big bad guy runs at him, and the energy is coming at him. And somehow, there it goes over his shoulder. Something happens in there where he doesn't get hit in the stomach and go flying across the room. The other guy does. And so I was reading, this is 2 or 3 months ago, and I found the answer out of the blue. I wasn't even looking for it. This is from John Amaro. Things always create their opposites. Good, bad, light, shadow, happiness, sorrow. The trick is to cultivate that transcendent middle zone of real life, the place of clear awareness where those opposites inform each other and that which goes beyond them is revealed. It is the middle way which is the resolution of opposites. It's not just halfway between indulgence and suppression, half happiness, half suffering. It's the pivot that the pendulum swings from. And I went, ah. There. You don't even look at it, you know? You're busy looking at this nut going back and forth. But there it sits. It's the pivot that the pendulum swings from, not the halfway mark at the bottom of the arc, which is where the vanilla is. It's by knowing the extremes of hell and paradise and not being confused by either that the heart opens to that dimension that is free of all ups and downs, pasts and futures, gains and losses, and that is truly free of all suffering. This is the heart at ease in hell and in paradise, and this is the place to enjoy a true holy day. And after I read that, suddenly all kinds of examples of teaching that's been there all along started kind of popping up, and I'd like to share a few of those and then read a couple of other things to you which are so beautifully stated that I couldn't possibly paraphrase them. It's better to get the real thing. Meditation. What are the ways that we are taught to actually live in that place up here? And meditation is the obvious first one. Meditation, I read something recently where someone just described it as the way we find our own inner balance. And this is kind of unlike this pendulum. It's where this example sort of breaks down, because the pendulum is probably, you know, nailed to the wall or something like that. But we are not. And how do we find our own inner balance? People who are balancing, have you ever watched somebody ride, I think it's called a unicycle? They're perfectly balanced, but they're always moving. Even something like these big trees that we live amidst. Outside my room, there are two trees, and I look at them every day, and one of them is, they're very close together, maybe about 3 feet apart. Big old cedar trees, I think. One is like this, and the other one goes like this. And so probably if you could run fast forward back several hundred years, you could see what happened to this one and how it achieved that balance, because up here they're parallel, but over here it's a big bend. So even things that seem to us completely immovable are always finding balance, their own balance. This is another childhood one that I remembered just this morning, actually, about 15 minutes ago. Do you remember again? You'd have the kid, when you were a kid, one kid would put their arm out, and a couple of other people would just apply pressure on it, and you just try to keep your arm there. Do you remember? And then what happens when they let go? Your arm doesn't shoot up in the air. Your arm goes like this, involuntarily. I thought of that when I was thinking about the tree. You know, that this is much faster, but in meditation, we're sitting there all the time, and things are coming, and we're constantly readjusting. We catch ourselves shooting off with a memory in one direction, and we gradually bring ourselves back in again. This week is our precepts week. And some time ago, I ran into a version of the precepts which was attributed to Bodhidharma. And they referred to it as Bodhidharma's one mind precepts. And one of the examples that I found actually had Bodhidharma's rendering of each precept with Dogen's commentary underneath, and Dogen's commentary being the one that we read in the Kyoju Kaiman. And I'm not going to read them all, but the way that it's expressed is quite interesting if you think about that still point, the point of balance. Each one starts off like this. Self-nature is inconceivably wondrous. That's the place right there. This is the Buddha nature. This is whatever you would like to call it. But this is that still, vast, empty space that we all can experience. And going from this inconceivable, wondrous nature, he goes on, and like the first one, he says, in the everlasting Dharma, not raising the view of extinction is called killing. So when you're in that place at the top, extinction, causing extinction, is a real swing. And not doing that is called killing. Self-nature is inconceivably wondrous. In the ungraspable Dharma, not arousing the thought of gain is called not stealing. There's gain swinging over the other way. And every precept is like that. It has this statement of what that place of balance, or that the Buddha described in the teaching of the Middle Way, that place in between the extremes, not a place on the yardstick, but the place where self-nature is inconceivably wondrous. There's another one here. Self-nature is inconceivably wondrous. In the genuine, all-pervading Dharma, not clinging to one single thing is called not being stingy. And you know, when I bumped into these one-mind precepts, I was really surprised because, I mean, maybe everybody knows about these. I'd never heard of them. And I only found a few references to them when I was looking, but they're so lovely. So, what are some other practices that are part of our practice? We hear about them all the time. Are you familiar with? You've heard people talk about the four Brahma Vihara, the four divine abodes, and the fourth one is equanimity. When we're sitting in the place of equanimity, the opposites simply are. You know, they could simply be are, I mean, simply be in full technicolor with lots of action and whatever, but they simply are. We don't climb into our television set, you know. It's I found a poem about equanimity. It says, if your mind becomes firm like a rock and no longer shakes, in a world where everything is shaking, your mind will be your greatest friend and suffering will not come your way. Isn't that lovely? When earlier in February, when we were observing, I don't know if you say celebrating the Buddha's parinirvana, and we read the scripture of the Buddha's last teachings a couple of times beforehand and then again at the ceremony, there were a couple of things mentioned there which in fact are more perfect examples of how to practice the middle way. And the one I was surprised to hear about the first time I read it was contentment, knowing what is enough. And I ran into something just this week. This woman wrote, the sole cause of human unhappiness is our inability to remain quietly at home in our rooms. Not in the sense of being a hermit or anything like that, but it is enough. It is enough. I don't have to leave my room. I don't have to leave my sitting place in order to find true happiness. We don't have to look for something bigger or better or warmer or colder. I can think of this now as the Goldilocks syndrome. It's like another one that surprised me. The first time I heard it in the Buddha's last teachings, and probably for any number of times after that, was when he suddenly launched into modesty. Because I've always thought of modesty as being what happens when, you know, you change your clothes and you always have a towel around you or something like that. I never thought of people who live a modest life, who live in a modest home, who know what's enough, who don't seek recognition, who may be real bodhisattvas performing amazing, helping activities, but seek, they're invisible. They seek nothing. They seek no recognition or acknowledgement or thanks. They just, that's what they do, and then they just move on. Also, modesty is a way of describing how we moderate our own senses. We no longer are the life of the party, or at the slightest hiccup, sobbing in the corner. We, gradually, we develop modest expressions of those same emotions. Not that we don't feel them, but our expression becomes modest. The last two I never thought of as practices that we teach or that I've even heard a whole lot spoken of, but I'd like to read you something a little bit longer about both of them because I found them so lovely and so helpful. The first one is the practice of forbearance. That's not something that I'm really familiar with, but I'll share what this is from. This first one was a John Omero that I read about. The still place at the top of the pendulum. This is Norman Fisher, who used to be, well, he's one of, in the Suzuki Roshi lineage, and when, at the time when they were having abbots of limited tenure, just a few years, Norman Fisher was one of the abbots. And this is what he says about forbearance. He says, the practice of forbearance is my favorite spiritual discipline. Though it is not very popular or exciting, forbearance is the greatest of all spiritual qualities because without it, all other good qualities, intentions, insights, and powers will be wiped away as soon as the first leopard, serpent, or boar appears in the vicinity. You can be strong, intelligent, kind, say your prayers every day, meditate till your legs fall off. You can have beautiful spiritual experiences, meet God face to face, serve your neighbor with compassion and zeal. You can be creative and talented in many ways. But if you are not ready and able to hang in there when conditions suddenly and fiercely change, then your spiritual practice, however devoted or brilliant it may be, is, in the final analysis, pretty useless. It's the changes, the constant shifts and sudden reversals that prove us, so we ought to appreciate them, even look forward to them, unpleasant though they may be at times, for it is thanks to them that we are forced to develop forbearance. The Chinese ideograph for forbearance is a heart with a sword dangling over it. Another instance of language's brilliant way of showing us something surprising and important, fossilized inside the meaning of a word. Vulnerability is built into our hearts, which can be sliced open at any moment by some sudden shift in the arrangements, some pain, some horror, some hurt. We all know and instinctively fear this, so we protect our hearts by covering them against exposure. But this doesn't work. To practice forbearance is to appreciate and celebrate the heart's vulnerability and to see that the slicing or piercing of the heart does not require defense, that the heart's vulnerability is a good thing because wounds can make us more peaceful and more real, if, that is, we are willing to hang on to the leopard of our fear, the serpent of our grief, the boar of our shame, without running away or being hurled off. Forbearance is simply holding on steadfastly with whatever it is that unexpectedly arises, not doing anything, not fixing anything, because doing and fixing can be a way to cover up the heart. Just holding on for dear life, holding on with what comes, is what makes life dear. And it's, you know, this description certainly isn't what leaps to mind when you think of the middle way, but it's perfect, at least. It's the last one is waiting. Waiting is very precious to me. I've had some experience with what happens when practicing waiting, and when I found someone affirming it in a, you know, in a description, you know, I got pretty excited. But I can give you an couple of examples which, from my own life with waiting, when I was a very new mother, old enough to have a child who could pull themselves up by the side of the crib, but not much else, I was working full-time and my daughter was in that state, and she developed the habit, which I found out later is quite common, of being unable to stay asleep or to fall asleep in a crib alone. And what she would do was haul herself up and scream, and if somebody didn't turn up, she'd pitch herself out onto the floor. Not only that, she could wake up every hour or so and do the same thing. And so I was getting really close to the end of my tether because I was, you know, holding down a full-time job and then being afraid to even go to sleep at night because I was going to hear this scream and then the crash on the floor. So I went to the pediatrician. And I said, what can I do? He said, well, you've got two choices if you want to do something other than what you're doing. Is you can either take a tranquilizer when you go to bed or you can give her one. And he gave them to me. And I didn't do anything. And she stopped doing it. But, you know, I asked for help, didn't follow it, but it resolved itself. And maybe if I hadn't even asked him, maybe if I had just waited, It would have just resolved itself. The other one was quite different. A house in our neighborhood caught fire, and the whole neighborhood was out watching, and the fire engines all came up. And I'd never been that close to a fire, and I expected them all to jump out and run around and start doing things, and they didn't. They stood out in the street and talked to each other and looked at the house. And they made a plan. And then they did something. And it was all very calm and controlled. One person crawled on the roof and cut a hole, you know. But it was the complete opposite to what my impression was of the correct action in a large emergency. Is get in there, you know, throw yourself in there and get busy. Well, I'd like to read you something that Norman Fisher has to say about racing. Waiting. For most of my years at the Zen Center, I had the job of guiding the many people who came there as full-time residential students. I found that often people came not out of a burning interest in Zen Buddhism, but simply because they didn't know what else to do. Many of them were lost in some way, stalled and stuck. Some were young, just beginning their grown-up lives, and some were older, and their lives had fallen apart, or they had broken apart their lives because they knew something wasn't right. The friends and relatives of these people may have worried about their going to the Zen Center, where they would be learning no useful marketable skills or furthering their life aims in any concrete way. The Zen Center didn't even offer the benefits of a therapeutic or human potential community, where at least, presumably, you were going to be healed or learn something about yourself. At the Zen Center, you would merely practice meditation and chanting, attend lectures on Zen, and do plenty of work. From any objective or even subjective point of view, all this, while possibly interesting, is more or less a waste of time. But I felt quite differently. It didn't bother me that people stumbled into the Zen Center in their confusion, sometimes not even realizing how lost they were, and probably looking for something they were not going to find. I believe that, below their surface confusion, a deeper wisdom had guided them there. Although the Zen Center would teach them little and do almost nothing for their resumes, their coming there was precisely the right thing for them to do. Unable to go along with life choices that looked outwardly to be moving them forward, these people were coming to the Zen Center, whether they realized it or not, simply to wait. They were coming to do nothing, to go nowhere, but simply to wait. Sometimes the waiting was frustrating to them. They often wondered what they were doing there, and they often complained, wanting the Zen Center to give them more than it ever could. Nevertheless, it was a great advantage to them to be where they were, dissatisfied, frustrated, and stuck as they often felt. At least they had no illusions that something was going on. They couldn't fool themselves about their lives or distract themselves somehow. At the Zen Center, they had to face themselves right where they were each and every day. There was nothing else going on. This being stuck and stalled, this waiting and going nowhere may sound terrible, but it's not. The journey of return, which is to that place, begins with uncertainty. Do not rush to clear this up, much as you like, may want to. At this point, here and now, admit your situation, know it for what it is, and be willing to endure it. Waiting may be uncomfortable, but it is profound and necessary. Most of us are too impatient to wait. We can't sit still for it and rush forward with more plans and schemes, actions of all sorts. But where does this all actually get us but into lives that are elaborate avoidance mechanisms? Waiting is a paradox. We are waiting, but not for something. We are waiting for nothing. I found another little gem of a line about waiting from another writer, there is a special way of waiting upon truth, setting our hearts upon it, yet not allowing ourselves to go out in search of it. Setting our hearts on it. And that brought me to my last example that popped into my mind the other night when I was the Heavenly Guardian and doing the ceremony in the Achalanatha Shrine. May we within our own hearts dwell amidst the myriad mountains. Hail, hail, hail. Thank you.